Welcome everyone to this interview where I'm super excited to be talking with Dr. David Brady. Firstly, Dr. David Brady, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Hey, thank you. It's great to be with you again. I think we've done this a few times already, so let's do one more round.
We have. I always enjoy our interviews, and I also you came very kindly a few years ago to an in-person training for our practitioner team, which I know was immensely well received as well.
Almost 2 years ago, I was just thinking about that this morning. It'll be 2 years in June. It's hard to believe. It seems like a couple of months ago. It was an entirely different world when I was over there a year ago, right?
I remember it with a certain level of envy because you were leaving to go to the Nuremberg Grid to go car racing the next day. So I were waving you off in the Uber thinking, I wish I was going to.
I have some stories about that, but I'll tell you offline.
Okay, great. So we're going to talk about long COVID from the lens of functional medicine. And I think this is an important dialogue. And I think particularly as we'll get into, David, because of some of the experiences your wife has had, you've had a particular lens, I think, into seeing this. Just to give people Dr. Brady's background, Dr. David Brady is a foremost authority on properly diagnosing and treating fibromyalgia, chronic gastrointestinal and autoimmune conditions, and has published in leading peer-reviewed medical journals, including Open Journal of Rheumatology, Autoimmune Disease and Integrative Medicine, a clinician's journal. In private practice at Whole Body Medicine in Fairfield, Connecticut, and also you were saying to me off camera, half the year in Florida now as well. Dr. Brady is additionally the former longtime vice president of the Division of Health Sciences and director of the Human Nutrition Institute at the University of Bridgeport, where he continues to serve as an associate professor of clinical sciences. He's also the chief medical officer of Designs for Health Incorporated and Diagnostic Solutions Laboratory LLC. So, David, I think a good starting point would just be to set a little bit of a frame around this conversation. This sort of condition of long COVID is something that's been emerging really over the last 9, 10 months or so. When we talk about long COVID, what are we actually talking about?
Well, that's a great question, and people are still trying to define it. But I can, here right on my desk, major paper, very thick, right, trying to define long haul COVID. This is a multi-center study with researchers in London, New York, and in Portland, in Oregon, and in three major, academic health centers. So it is getting a lot of attention, and it's starting to get some rapid funding. And people are trying to kind of get their arms around it and define it, but in a more formal way, sort of in a more diagnostic criteria, academic way. But, in the front lines as clinicians, as physicians, we've been dealing with this for a while now and trying to figure it out as we go. It has, a lot of similarities to things that we deal with quite frequently in more of the functional integrative medicine realm. And some differences. So, we noticed it right away, actually, that people who either were confirmed positive on a PCR test or some sort of diagnostic test with COVID-19, or just never had a positive test, but had all of the hallmark clinical symptoms where just, there's no way it would be anything else. When they got over if they were lucky enough to get over the acute, respiratory symptoms and temperature and things like that, most of my long haul patients actually never got better totally. It's not like their symptoms went away, they got all better and then they got hit later. They just never, their symptoms never fully resolved and just sort of changed and morphed over time. But we've definitely seen commonality in the symptom profile and clusters across all of these long haulers, across the world too. I mean, this study I just picked up that I have on my desk right now, and it's in a stack of others, right? There is respondents in there from 56 different countries. So this isn't a localized phenomena with, in one geographical region of the world or in one subset of people of a certain genetic, lineage or culture or gender or anything. It's just sort of wide ranging. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, And then know that you had a particular deepening, perhaps, of your interest in this because your wife has been affected. Perhaps you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, my lovely wife, Stacy, she, just to give you a little bit of a preview, I mean, she really, really healthy gal. You know, she was a professional dancer and a dance instructor her whole life. So exceedingly fit. I couldn't keep up with her, you know, doing physical things, exercise, things like that. Great diet, good body composition, no comorbidities, you know, no hypertension, no sugar problems. I mean, she's just sort of the model of health for someone in their, you know, mid 40s. And she, in March, all of a sudden started getting shortness of breath, like air hunger, like starving for air. And then she got very fatigued. And then she would get really, really rapid heartbeat, like tachycardic, to the point where feeling like panicked about it. And she got some other weird stuff. Like she got a lot of joint pain, a lot of pain around the rib cage, which is a really common symptom in COVID and long haul COVID. And she never lost her taste and smell. She never got that classic symptom, but she got another classic symptom that's really novel and unique to COVID. And maybe you've heard of this, people stating that they feel almost like a buzzing or like a vibratory, energetic kind of sensation in their body in different areas, like down through their limbs and things like that. Almost like a fizzing inside the body. And I've had multiple people describe it like that, you know, on their own, spontaneously. And how many, you know, how often would someone come up with fizzing, right?
Yeah, it's an unusual choice of word, yeah.
Yeah, as a descriptor. And so she had that. And she got pretty bad. And this is March in the northeast of the U.S. And, you know, at that point, New York was melting down with COVID. Everyone was bailing out to the outer suburbs. So Connecticut, New Jersey, and, you know, they were just bailing out. And so those systems started becoming overwhelmed. So the last thing I wanted is to bring her to an emergency room in a hospital in that region, and then God forbid end up in the ICU. And at that time they were not doing very well with how they were treating acute COVID. They were
we've learned a lot since then, right?
Yeah, they were rushing people to ventilators, treating it like any old other viral pneumonia, and it wasn't having good outcomes, put it that way. And ironically enough, you know, they're so, medicine today is so standard of care protocol driven. Despite the bad outcomes, they just kept doing it, hoping that, you know, maybe it would somehow work. It actually took some really brave acute care ICU docs that actually make videos and put them on YouTube and TikTok and all of that, that to basically say, hey, we got to stop rushing people to ventilators. We're killing them. You know, we need to do something different here. We need to rethink it, relook at it. This is not your typical viral pneumonia. And that was the leverage to try to, you know, start getting things to change a little bit. But back to my wife, I didn't want her going anywhere near that environment. So luckily, you know, I'm in a group medical practice, integrated medical practice in Connecticut. So I was able to get to my practice, and I literally brought home, you know, IV unit, you know, IV stringers. And I was doing, you know, high dose of me and my partner in the practice was helping, Dr. Briner was very, very helpful in this. You know, we were doing high dose vitamin C, Myers cocktails. We were doing blood ozone and hemolumen, where we were radiating pass through blood with, you know, infrared to kill pathogens and UV. And then we were injecting ozone. We were doing nebulized glutathione, you know, every supplement you can imagine. Wow. Any medication that was coming out that the data looked good on. And it was just everything in a quest to keep her out of the hospital. Luckily I was able to get a home oxygen unit. Now I'd have to say that did more than anything, having,
is that, you right? know, wow.
higher percentage of oxygen for her to put on when she would get these intermittent air hunger, you know, really bad thing. And it was definitely interesting. It was worse at night. So when the evening time would come, she would get a lot worse. So
and how long was that acute period for?
Probably about 2 weeks to 3 weeks. It was pretty bad. It would seem like it would get better and then boom, it would hit again. Meanwhile, she was never positive. I'm the chief medical officer of a laboratory that was doing, we were one of the first FDA approved through the emergency use authorization for a real-time PCR diagnostic COVID-19. Right. Nasopharyngeal swab. So, here I am, I have access to all this stuff and I swabbed her myself. So I know I collected the sample, right? A couple of times and she never came up positive. She didn't, now maybe she just never produced that kind of viral load in the upper respiratory tract. Cause she never got like acute lung injury, or acute respiratory distress syndrome to the point I would say it was anything like that, but it was scary. I mean, and if I didn't have access, if I didn't have the knowledge, first of all, and I didn't have the access to have those kind of things brought into the house, she would have ended up in the hospital and I don't know what route she would have went down, because at that time, at least where we were in Connecticut, doctors weren't seeing people in ambulatory practice. I mean, if you called your primary care physician or your internal medicine doc or any specialist, you got the answer machine. It was like, go to the hospital. It was hospital or nothing, yeah, essentially. And I actually never thought I'd see our medical care, delivery system in the United States reduced to that. It was really go to the hospital or stay home and do the best you can.
It was,
right?
Same here, yeah.
Take care of yourself and get through it. Or if it gets really, really bad and you're thinking you're going to die, then come to the hospital. Right. So I think it was a real wake up call for a lot of people. I hope they don't forget the lesson. People forget the lessons quick. I think it was a wake up call. It was shocked people. Yeah. They were trained to think, oh, modern medicine's always going to have some magic bullet now.
There's always going to be a bed for me. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's going to be, no big deal. They forgot that it wasn't that long ago that there were things that wiped out big parts of the population, even back in the earlier 20th century with influenza epidemics and Spanish flu and things like that. So that's what we were reduced to. And it was funny how people went back real quick and they relearned and they found things like elderberry and echinacea and vitamin C and zinc. And, they went back to stuff that actually does work, right? It's just been pushed to the side because it's not economically, the engine anymore. And it's not the model, but they went back. And, I was actually, Alex, I was getting phone calls on my cell phone from ICU doctors in New York hospitals, tracking me down somehow on my cell phone, asking me how to do high dose vitamin C drips.
Wow.
And my cocktails. I had a doc from a hospital in Massachusetts call and wanted to know how they can do, like, really quickly do some sort of pilot trial on blood ozone in a hospital.
Wow. That's great. Those questions are being asked.
It was great.
It's also shocking.
But I thought I was living in some bizarro land. Like I landed on some other planet, I never thought that would happen, but on the other side, we were ramping up like crazy, dropping what we normally do testing wise and trying to just contribute. And we were a molecular shop. So we developed one of the first COVID, PCR tests and then antibody tests and things like that. And on the nutraceutical side at Designs for Health, we were just trying to keep people with immune products so that, if they have quercetin or resveratrol or vitamin C or immunotone or something like that, botanicals, elderberry or something that they can get them, because the shelves are just
gone. I remember the phone calls from our patients, and I was calling the distributors and the supplement companies, and I was like, guys, I've sold a year's worth of product in the last 48 hours. What do you want? It was insane.
We were running our plants on three shifts. I mean, like 24 hours a day, trying to keep everyone healthy. We were one of the first companies in the U.S. to do broad-based employee testing. To try to keep everyone healthy. I think sales of all of our immune related product SKUs went up 400% in March and April.
Yeah.
So it was just a mad scramble. And then we were looking at the data coming out real time and designing new products to get to market to try to help it be more effective, but also easier for people. Because, you know, it's difficult, especially people are not used to this model of care and using supplements, to take vitamin D and zinc and elderberry and vitamin C, you know. So we were putting things together, like in, you know, effervescent drinks and things like that, to deliver everything in one shot, basically, and trying to rush that stuff out the door while I'm trying to keep my wife out of the hospital, right?
And that's intense.
Sticking her in the car and bringing her to my practice where we had more stuff available. So, you know, eventually she kind of cleared from the acute stuff, but she was left with, the most significant symptoms were definitely fatigue, like just lack of energy and vitality, like a chronic fatiguer, right? Worse post-exertional. And by exertional, I don't mean, you know, going and running a marathon. I mean, you know, walking across the house or, you know, trying to do a basic, you know, do the dishes, right? Or take the dog out for a little walk. I mean, she was struggling, and this was an athlete. This was a professional.
It must have been really tough for her as well, that contrast of really life so quickly.
Yeah. And then, you know, but, you know, we had a similar experience because both of my sons, you know, we lived in Connecticut, kind of in the woods with the stream and deer everywhere, ticks everywhere. They both got Lyme and co-infection. So they spent a year or two in a similar situation, from that. So we kind of, and she was the main caretaker. I was off working and taking care of other patients, you know. So she's real knowledgeable. I mean, I should give her an honorary nutrition degree and all that. Really knows her stuff. And, but, you know, that one of the biggest things, burdens on her was psychologically that she couldn't take care of her family and take care of her kids, you know.
It's very hard.
So besides the fatigue, though, just that really weird rib pain was probably the worst for about a month. She felt like she had someone sticking a knife in her back. And if anyone's ever had what, you know, what the chiropractors will say, oh, you have a rib out, like in the back, like it feels like there's literally like a javelin sticking through your rib cage. She would get those pains and they would come and then they would shut off, right? And I've had that across the board in so many long haulers, this weird chest wall rib cage pain. And I had her, I got her an MR, CT, post contrast. I even did stuff I don't normally do just to find out, did she have micro clots in her lungs? Cause then it was going around with those, you know, micro clots, little pulmonary embolisms things. I'm like, you know, but she wouldn't get the pain. The pain wasn't pleuritic, like it didn't vary with her breathing. So it didn't seem like a pulmonary, you know, a pleural type of problem. She wasn't short of breath when she'd have the pain. So it didn't all add up like a PE or a pleuritis or something like that. So, and then she started getting migratory joint pains, almost like she had rheumatoid arthritis, you know, like mainly in the hands, the small joints of the hands and wrists, and a lot of muscle ache, just achiness. So almost very, very similar to the patient symptom profiles we see both in fibromyalgics, classic fibromyalgia patients, and the, you know, ME/CFS patients as well. And I think it's just part and parcel of the fact, and I think it reinforces what I think a lot of us, so, you know, there are many of the researchers, but certainly those of us in functional and integrative medicine, that a lot of the ME/CF, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, and potentially even classic fibromyalgia really behave as an immunodysfunctional problem that affects multiple systems, organs, and tissues that is related to some past infection, right? So a self-infection. So whether it's the classic post-viral, you know, the easiest is, post-viral fatigue is not all that abnormal, but you know, to see that larger constellation of symptoms. I think the closest thing I can make an analogy of COVID long haul to is chronic or tertiary Lyme disease or co-infections and some ME/CFS patients, particularly the post-viral ones. So, you know, many studies, but this one that I held up, you know, I'm just looking at here and it's frightening. I mean, they surveyed thousands and thousands of people that had COVID-19, you know, not many of them, same scenario, never really quite had the positive test, but they had enough of the hallmark symptoms and the whole clinical history, some hospitalized, some not. that they were, you know, categorized as those subjects with COVID, 93% of them in this study, months later, 7-8 months out, complain of some ongoing lingering symptoms that affect their daily life. So that's massive, right?
For sure. And
the first study looked at the Bergamo. Remember when Italy, the Bergamo was, you know, massively hit, elderly population and so forth. The first study, really one of the first studies on long haul COVID was in Bergamo, and they contacted everyone in that region who was hospitalized with COVID. And that first study showed that more than 50% of them still had life-altering symptoms. So if you run the numbers on how many people, everyone's, you know, obviously, and you understand why, they're concentrating on acute COVID and deaths from COVID.
Yeah.
You know, I get it, right? It's the low-hanging fruit. People are dying. I get it. But I don't think the population, I don't think public health authorities, governments, anything have even come close to start grappling with what this is going to mean in the much longer term.
I agree with you.
We had a lot of ME/CFS patients and patients that, you know, are not getting solutions from the conventional medical routes when they go from specialist to specialist to specialist. Finally, they usually find their way into a functional or integrative medicine doctor or a nutritionist or like your clinic or my clinic. I think we're going to be absolutely overrun in the next decade.
Yeah. It happened for us in fact, we just put out the day of recording this, a video sort of explaining what happened, that we had to start running waiting lists last summer. We had to stop putting out any newsletters because every time we sent out an email, we just had a massive flood of people coming. We just didn't have the capacity to deal with. And I think it's interesting, getting COVID at this point doesn't particularly scare me because I'm pretty likely to survive. What scares me is the long COVID stories that I'm seeing that are, and then that just sort of leads into my question of what's your observation at this point? And obviously all of our understanding is still evolving on this topic, but what's your observation at this point of why some people develop this sort of long haul situation and others don't? And you spoke to it briefly just now, but I'd just like to open that up a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right, or questions. And we're looking at that in the laboratory. You know, we were doing a lot of PCR COVID diagnostic testing, but with hospital partners, and we were able to, in parallel to that, get serum or plasma to do parallel antibody IgG, IgM
that's
testing.
Cool. Wow.
And at times, we were getting stool, and we were doing PCR, you know, SARS-CoV-2 screening in the GI tract. And toward the end, we were starting to get buccal swabs and we're running genomics on them. So, and there are many centers that are trying to look at, you know, what are unique in the genomics or the SNP patterns in patients who go down that road to, you know, acute respiratory distress syndrome, respirator and death versus those who get it and are asymptomatic or very mildly symptomatic. But not only look at the genes and the SNPs, but the metabolomics, the microbiomics, what is going on? Clearly, there is a, you know, inherent genetic predisposition for some people to go down this really acute route, even if they're extremely healthy. I mean, we've had Olympic athletes, you know, level athletes that die, right? I mean, so, but most people don't, right? You have in the high 90% chance of surviving unless you're elderly, obese, have a lot of comorbidities and so forth. But there are definitely outliers to it. What makes those people outliers to go down the acute route? They're still trying to mine that. And they've found some things along cytokine pathways and different things that may make people susceptible. They've even found higher predilections in certain sort of groups that came from different areas of the world, higher likelihood. But the long haul thing's a little different. We don't know. It's hard to even do the studies at this point because there's no universal agreed upon definition of what long haul is,
right?
So until you have a bit like these, this is someone with long haul, this is not, it's hard to do any kind of clean studies. And that's why research on fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, is real dirty and always has been, because exactly.
And it's why it's taken so long to even get recognition and definition of subgroups and everything else. It's like,
yeah, they have entirely different criteria on who has it and who doesn't. So how do you do clean research, right? So I think that will come, but
what's your hunches at this point? And I'm not going to hold you to these in years to come, but I'm sort of curious as to, let me rephrase that slightly. What are the kind of experimental questions that you're asking with enthusiasm at this point?
Yeah, I think it's multifactorial, but one of the biggest ones, actually, there was just a really good study published and put out by Risto Vojjani and his son as well, who's a medical researcher, and Tis Kazarian on looking at cross-reactivity. It was a laboratory study, but it was looking at cross-reactivity of the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, envelope protein, and a couple of the nasty proteins that the virus does its dirty work with, and the vaccines are targeted against, right? And what is their predilection for cross-reactivity with various human host tissues? And the results were frightening. The cross-reactivity, I've never seen cross-reactivity of pathogenic proteins that was that vast across tissues, from neurological to vascular to renal to cardiac to brain. I mean, it's just amazing. So what it does bring up is the specter of significant molecular mimicry type crossover autoimmunity in humans having been exposed to SARS-CoV-2 and then later going on to develop autoimmune conditions. I'm concerned about this, not only from the initial viral infection, I'm also concerned about it with the vaccines, because we know vaccines are very prone to cause autoimmune disease. It's their most common side effect. I mean, you can read the work of Yehuda Schoenfeld and many others, and you look at the incidence of autoimmunity of all types across the Western world, and the more and more and more and more aggressive immunization schedules and adjuvants and things like that. Now, you can make a very good argument, well, you know, the positive outweighs the negative, and you can argue it from the herd immunity benefit, or you can argue it from the risk of the individual, and they're two very different places to argue it from. So, and I'm not here to really debate vaccines or immunizations. I'm not universally against them, nothing like that. But we know that autoimmunity is the biggest potential problem. And we know the largest number of side effects, even of these new vaccines for COVID-19, are autoimmune related conditions, you know, neurological conditions and things like that.
And there seems to be something in the long haul sort of crowd of sort of mast cell activation and some sort of system getting sort of overloaded and not being able to switch off. And I wonder if that's something that you're seeing.
It's that classic feed forward, you know, slippery funnel thing, where some people, when they're exposed to this virus, it's almost like their body's defense mechanism to the virus is worse for them than the virus, right? Potential or the mechanisms of hopeful cure are worse than the disease, in that they go into, you know, the classic was the cytokine storm or the bradykinin storm and all of that, that they just ratchet up their cytokine system in ways that's, you know, highly inflammatory, in a very, very aggressive posture. And then they're priming T cells, they're creating changes across their immune response that are then transitioning, like in molecular mimicry, where they start not only attacking the virus, they're just attacking, it's friendly fire, they're just attacking anything that even looks remotely like the virus, or like, you know, one of the proteins on the virus. And, you know, they're inflaming their synovium, they're getting inflammatory arthritides, they're inflaming their peripheral nerves, and they're getting these weird neurological neuropathies, they're inflaming their blood vessels and endothelium, and they're getting blood clots and vascular problems. They're getting they're getting cross-reactivity and autoimmune inflammatory damage to their myocardium, and actually having heart problems and brain. You know, the top three symptoms that long haulers complain of, the first one is fatigue, right? The second one is post-exertional malaise, right? So it's like another type of fatigue. And then it's pain, you know, broad-based pain across the body. And I think actually I'll look in this exact study. Yeah, it was fatigue, post-exertional malaise. Oh, and third was actually cognitive dysfunction. That's what actually got me talking down that line. I talked about cross-reactivity with the brain. So you're having a hard time thinking clearly. And hey, it's what we've been treating for decades.
I was going to say, it all sounds terribly familiar to some of us.
It's like ME/CFS on steroids, as they said, right? Yeah.
You know, one of the things that we're seeing, which is also interesting, and it reminds me of your work around how you label classic fibromyalgia, that the work that we've been doing for many years around calming what we call a maladaptive stress response and a sort of overactivated nervous system response, obviously it's not the only piece of the jigsaw, but as a part of the jigsaw, that work seems to be having quite a big impact on some of this crowd as well. And I was curious as to if you were seeing some of that, particularly given some of your historical work around fibromyalgia.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever people get into this ratcheted up kind of feed forward, it's almost like emergency time, you know, fight or flight, right? Like they're just, you know, they're in emergency mode biologically. And that includes, you know, central nervous system excitation and going into a state of hypervigilance, right? So, and we see this in long haulers, anxiety when they didn't have it before, insomnia like crazy, you know, their mind won't shut off and they're anxious, or their heart's beating like crazy. They have tachycardia at night. So yeah, that hypervigilance, sympathetic dominant type of state, it's hard to feel good and be healthy in that state for any length of time. It's supposed to be very, very brief, a biological response to get out of harm's way. It's not supposed to be a persistent thing. So yeah, we've been using things, you know, anxiolytics of various types, including, you know, natural ones, whether it's, you know, fermented GABA, theanine, ashwagandha, German chamomile, other types of calming botanicals to deal with that aspect of it. I find that a lot of them have sort of energy deficient state almost universally throughout the cells. So I know there's been a lot of work done, a lot of it over in your neck of the woods there on NAD plus, you know, generation with, you know, NMN and MR, you know, or NR to just produce more NAD plus and mitochondrial function. So using those NAD plus generators with CoQ10 and L-carnitine and ribose and things like that.
Good old classic mitochondrial support. Again, we're definitely seeing that's helping, yeah.
It's definitely helping. It's not like a cure, right? Even NAD drips, you know, like IV. But we've been using a lot of functional peptides. So we're using immunomodulatory peptides that we would have used before in just autoimmune conditions, you know, whether it's MS or RA or lupus or whatever, we're using them in long haul. So like thymosin alpha 1 is an immune modulatory peptide that I have my wife on it. She's done much better on it. Once again, it wasn't universally curative, but it definitely moved the dial. And we generally see that. And then there's a mitochondrial messaging peptide that really can upregulate and enhance exogenous energy production, and it's called SS31. So we're using that. There's, there's a couple of other immune peptides. I haven't used this one much, but some colleagues of mine have. It's thymosin beta 4. And then for the pain, we've used the BCP157 peptide. So, and peptides, if for people who don't know, like insulin is probably the most broadly used peptide. It's, it's more amino acids strung together than you would call an amino acid formula, but it's less than would be like a drug or nutraceutical, which is much more compound or much more complex type of product. So it's specific amino acid motifs or sequences that have signaling properties in the body, and they can be very, very powerful signaling properties. So they're less like drugs that go in and like swing a big hammer at one target, like they knock down an enzyme's function or they block a receptor or they facilitate a receptor. The peptides are more going in as signaling agents, telling the body what to do in different ways.
Which tends to be a little less stimulating, a little bit gentler for the system as well.
But it's interesting. I don't know what's going on with the environment in the UK, but in the United States, the peptide therapy and exosomes and things like that have gotten extremely popular with the integrative and functional medicine doctors because they work so well. They really move the dial. And before, they were kind of in this gray zone. They weren't drugs. They weren't supplements. They were somewhere in the middle. They were falling in between the regulatory cracks. And, you know, they required a doctor's prescription to a compounding pharmacist, and they would provide or build the peptide matrix. But now, you know, our FDA is clamping down on peptides. They're clamping down on compounding pharmacies in general, making it very difficult for them to make any kind of custom therapeutics. I think they just want it all through the big pharmaceutical houses. And so many people turning to this therapy, and it's working so well, and the research is so good over in Europe on them. I think they're looking at it and going, uh-oh. So they want to regulate it. Pharma wants a piece of the pie. So some of these immunological modulating peptides, now the FDA has come in and said that, well, we're classifying them now as biologics, which are, you know, drugs, very expensive drugs used for autoimmunity. So they're basically saying, hey, listen, these are effectively unapproved biologic drugs. Clamping down on them. So how long we can access and use these things is anyone's guess. I'm hoping we can, because I think these things are massively important with trying to treat COVID long haul, along with those other things that we already use, things to calm the nervous system, things the mitochondria working. You know, we use some things that seem to be helpful in people when they're antiviral or antiviral docking. So it's pretty interesting. The things that we know and that we turn to that are beneficial to prevent you from getting COVID, or even to take when you have COVID, are also therapeutic and helpful in COVID long haul. So things like resveratrol and things like quercetin and vitamin C and all these plant bioflavonoids and polyphenols. And, you know, we're using them mainly to reduce getting COVID or during COVID, because those things can block viral adhesion or docking to the cell in specific mechanisms on the outside or inside of the membrane. Zinc, you know, some of the things can get more zinc in the cell, act as zinc ionophores, make it a, you know, hostile environment inside the cell for the virus. So it makes sense why all those things would work in preventing, or at least we hope reducing, the likelihood of you going on to clinical COVID-19 if you get exposed to SARS-CoV-2. Or potentially benefit you while you have an active infection. We're not sure why they seem to work in long haul, because no one has yet been able to identify that there's still, you know, 6-7 months later, active SARS-CoV-2 virus infection, or is it simply the leftover wreckage from the viral infection that basically reprogrammed your immune and inflammatory response? Yeah.
You know, it reminds me. Yeah, and it reminds me of when, you know, Optimum Health Clinic started out in sort of 2003. A lot of what we were doing was really experimental and like just figuring stuff out. Well, let's try that. And sort of being very honest with the patient community of saying, we're sort of learning together. And there's something for me at the moment with what's happening with the long haulers particularly, where I really like the fact that there's that freedom to be innovative, because they're not expecting definitive answers. We know we don't have definitive answers because we're still right at the beginning of figuring this thing out and trying different things. Some things that we know generally work well with the fatigue population, other things seem to work well in subgroups and not so in others. But there's something that I think is quite liberating about the approach.
Yeah, and that's why it's alarming when, you know, they can take the arrow out of your quiver, right? Because from a regulatory standpoint, and listen, I understand if there are reports of harm, right? And you're using agents that have a high likelihood of doing harm. The benefit of these is they really don't do any harm. They just, the worst that's going to happen is they're not going to work.
Right.
You know, which you can say, well, you know, cost people money and cost people time, false hope, but we're trying the best that we can, you know, but by and large, we're not using agents that, you know, are going to kill you or have really bad side effects. So I wish that was taken into account more, but I think, you know, some of it's cultural power, some of it's economics, some of it's politics. I mean, I've never seen a medical or a scientific topic become so politically polarized and inject it with politics than we saw with this pandemic. And it's really sad. It's shameful, actually, but it definitely happened. People took polar camps, even on therapeutics, based on their politics, which
was pretty insane.
I mean, even scientists did that, right?
Yeah. I mean, but I think there's also something which is very, I see it's potentially going to go one or two ways. It's either going to be that governments don't really invest the money and the energy that needs to be invested in really supporting the long haulers, which is then what's going to happen is those long haulers are going to start fighting for the already limited services that the ME/CFS sort of fibromyalgia populations are already struggling with. Or there's the potential for something new to happen, and there's the recognition that there are so many people that are being affected, and maybe it takes another year or two for the kind of acute crisis to settle, that it becomes clear. But there's then the potential for work that people like yourself have been doing for so many years to hopefully have their heyday and hopefully have the level of support and funding and interest that's deserved.
Yeah. I agree, unfortunately, and I'm generally not a pessimist. You know, I generally try to be glass half full. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that. I've just been around a long time. I've seen this all play out, you know. I think it will be treated just as chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia and chronic Lyme. I think they will ignore and pretend it doesn't exist as long as possible, until there is a viable, at least profitable pharmaceutical agent that will modify the symptoms enough to make the patient's existence just marginally better. It doesn't cure them. It makes them marginally better enough that they'll keep taking it every month. And then it will be real. And then you'll see, in the United States at least, you'll see television commercials all night long about it, because it'll become a real thing. I've seen it happen with multiple disorders and diagnoses. It wasn't real until there was a approved pharma agent. And then they got the diagnostic code actually recognized. And then it's a real thing, right? Until then, it doesn't, blah, 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 right? It doesn't exist, you know? This can't exist. I didn't learn about it in Yale Medical School or in Harvard Medical School. If they don't teach it there, it can't exist, because they know everything, Alex. They know everything already. They know everything about the body that ever can exist in the body and ever could go wrong in the body. They know it already. That's the attitude.
And I think it also goes back to one of the absolute fundamental principles of integrative and functional medicine approaches, which is we're not treating symptoms, we're treating underlying causes. And those pharmaceutical...
We
attempt, yeah. but that certainly the intention is to try. Yes, we might soften some symptoms, but the intention is to try and go for the underlying cause, and that's where.
And by the way, that used to be the intention of standard medicine too, and it morphed a couple of decades ago. And it wasn't the doctors who did it; it was the therapeutic agent design construct that did it. That. We don't really want to design things that cure stuff anymore, even if we can. We want to design things that manage chronic disease. We want to keep people sick enough that they need it, but alive enough to still go buy it right? Forever until they finally do die, right? So we want to keep them alive a long time as customers, but we want them miserable enough while they're alive to continue to buy our product. And, you know, it sounds so like, oh, this guy's off his rocker. I've just seen it. I've seen it happen. And I've seen the way the drugs develop. Yeah. Once in a while, you have a drug that comes out now, even with all our modern, you know, wonderful science, once in a while, you get a drug that comes out to cure something like the hepatitis C, you know, curative drugs. Yeah. Well, yeah, they're curative, and they cost $600,000 for a course of treatment when they came out.
What it is, wow.
Now it's like $250,000, right? So, yeah, So it's either they're going to drain the money out of everyone slowly every month, like selling inkjet cartridges for printers, right? Or they're really going to whack you.
That's
you
a
know?
Painful metaphor.
So it's unfortunate where everything is, you know, declined into. And I think people slowly, and this push it down the track faster. I think people woke up. Listen, they don't have every cure. They don't have any magic answer. Look, they were brought to their knees in this thing. They had no answers. So everyone went back to the old stuff, right? Yeah. And when I really needed my medical provider, they weren't there. Their office was closed. I got their answering machine, right? And so I think people have hopefully, some of them, enough of them woke up and said, I better take care of myself. I better not be obese. I better not have hypertension and diabetes and be on statins and on 10 other medications and eat like crap and go to the drive-thru. I need to be healthier, and it's not a guarantee. But there's no doubt people that were in better overall health fared much better in this pandemic. Yes. No reason to think this is going to be the last one, right?
Right. You know, one of the things I do think is different here is that for many years, the ME/CFS fibromyalgia populations have been sort of shrouded in this sort of idea that it's all in their mind or it's not a legitimate condition. And there's been a lot of fragmentation within those communities of fighting over sort of different sort of conceptual frameworks of what should be done. There does seem to be a level of unity and proactiveness among the long haulers in terms of the online communities, which seems to have a freshness and seems to have a sort of cleanness in a sense that I think is going to be powerful.
Yeah, I mean, my wife's very involved in a lot of the, online forums and discussion groups with long haulers where they can at least share their experiences on, you know, what may have helped them, what didn't help them, where are resources to go to, and just some kinship. You know, you always got to be careful about those things. I've always said, like in the fibromyalgia and the chronic fatigue groups, some of those groups can become sort of chronic disease pity fests, yep. You know, and
you got to be careful.
They do not facilitate recovery. They facilitate going further down into the rabbit hole. Certainly not all of them, but I think when done right, those things are incredibly important. You need to have a community. You need to have a support network that, you know, often goes beyond just your immediate social group. You need to deal with other people who are dealing with what you're dealing with. So I think they are really, really important. And you may be right. I hope you're right that this scenario is going to produce enough people with the issue that numerically they can't be ignored anymore.
Yeah. How is your wife doing now?
She's doing, if you asked her, I think if the answer is different every day, right? But that's just the nature of it. But I think overall, she's steadily getting less problems. But it's day to day. I mean, one day she can have a really good day, and the next day, all of a sudden, oh man, the pain came back, or the tachycardia is back, even taking the beta blocker, right? Or whatever. Or if she pushes it, you know, she just can't do the thing she used to. I mean, I describe it this way. Since March and she had COVID, she is metabolically a different human being. There's no doubt about it. Now, I'm hoping there's light at the end of the tunnel and someday she's back to exactly what she was. I hope that's the case. I just don't know. And believe me, we're doing everything. I'm throwing everything in at it and trying to, like, you know, I know somebody, you know, that does everything, right? So not everyone has that luxury.
But I think it's great that people like you that do, that can then use that as the place to really discover what does and doesn't work, going beyond just the pieces that are obviously in front of you.
Yeah, but you know, none of us have all the answers to this one. Not yet. I mean, I probably never will, but look at chronic Lyme. I mean, no one really still has great answers to that. I mean, there's all these protocols and all these, some people do well on this, most people don't, you know. I guess it's better and there are more options than there used to be, but I still don't think it's in great shape with treating.
I can always tell the practitioners that are living at the coalface because they talk with the sort of humility you just talked with, because I think that's the reality that, you know, there are, yes, there are those simple cases where we know what we do what we know that works and it works and it's a sort of wonderful thing. But there are a lot of these cases which are complicated, and that's where we learn and that's where we discover things, but it's also not smooth sailing.
And I tell that to all my patients, particularly now with the long haulers all coming in. I say, listen, don't look to me like some world expert on long haul syndrome. You know, I am not. I don't have all the answers here. I've had, you know, I come from a background of functional integrative metabolic medicine where we're used to dealing with these complex multifactorial kind of things that involve a lot of the components that you have in long haul, you know, the fatigue, the inflammation, the autoimmunity. And then I had this personal experience, you know, with trying to treat my own wife and so forth. So I may be in a better situation than just walking into your family doctor, but I am not, you know, the end all be all to this, but I'm going to do my best to help you. And I think more doctors should be like that. You know, I listen, I've gone into a patient room, I remember several times, and I walked into a patient in a room for a patient I've had for a while, you know, I was treating her for a while for a complex condition. And then I walked in and I put my hand out, it was before COVID, I put my hand out, shook her hand.
When we could shake hands, yeah.
Yeah, I said, hi, I'm Dr. Jones, nice to meet you. She goes, what are you talking about? She goes, you've been treating me for like a year, you're Dr. Brady. And I said, no, I'm not Dr. Brady. Today I'm Dr. Jones, because Dr. Brady evidently has no clue what's wrong with you. So we're starting again with me as Dr. Jones. Maybe I'll get better this time, right? So, and they usually laugh and they feel like, hey, you know, this guy's at least trying, you know?
I mean, that's a great place to end. Dr. Brady, people that want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, probably two places. One is my main professional just web presence is at drdavidbrady.com. So DR, not doctor spelled out, just drdavidbrady.com, drdavidbrady.com. So that has a lot of information about me and a lot of resources there, from interviews, podcasts, TV appearances, articles, papers, things like that, on a myriad of things. And then information on my practice and things. But then if you're more interested in my book, The FibroFix, my latest book, The FibroFix, then you can go to that dedicated website. So it's just FibroFix, FibroFix.com. So for people who have or been told they have fibromyalgia, even chronic fatigue syndrome, ME, they can probably learn a lot from the resources on that site and or reading the book.
It's awesome. Dr. Brady, thank you so much. I always enjoy our interviews. I think that I love the fact you bring the humility to it, but also there's a lot of hope in what you're saying as well. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Alex. Thanks for everything you do. You're doing good work.